Welcome to a special episode of the Baker Street Babes podcast. You're about to listen to the recording of the second class that Lindsay Fay teaches at the Center for Fiction in Manhattan about the Sherlock Holmes stories. This week, she talks about the death of Sherlock Holmes. We hope you enjoy.
Alrighty, are we all situated? So, thank you for coming back to Sherlock Holmes Chat Week 2. The death of Sherlock Holmes, and the resurrection of Sherlock Holmes, among other dubious events that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle made up. So, last time, I talked for a little bit about the authorial sort of context of how Doyle was faring when he wrote the short stories. Would you like me to go through a little bit of what was on his mind? Again, you got some of it, I think, in the Michael Chabon article, fan fictions on Sherlock Holmes. He covers some of what was going on in Doyle's head. But as early as November of 1891, as a matter of fact, our beloved Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was sick to death of Sherlock Holmes. He created this brilliant detective, and he didn't particularly care for the fact that he had created a brilliant detective. He, as I said before, was always a letter writer. He corresponded with a lot of people, particularly his mother, Mary. And he wrote to his mother, quote, "I think of slaying Holmes and winding him up for good and all." And that was November of 1891. So that's only half, really, of the adventures at that point, because his mother persuaded him to keep Sherlock Holmes and the series alive for another 2 years after that, because she said, "You've got a great thing going, you know, like, I don't see why you would put the kibosh on it quite that quickly." So the final problem, the adventure of the final problem, was published on December of 1893, 2 years after Conan Doyle first wanted to slay his hero. And that short story actually claimed that Holmes had been dead since 1891, which is interesting. The setting of it, rather than being contemporary during the year 1893, sort of posits that John Watson has been writing stories about his friend for the Strand magazine for 2 years after his friend died, which contextually is extremely interesting, I think. And in Chabon's article, you read the part where Michael Chabon talks about the story you are about to hear is true, and the techniques that Conan Doyle uses for that. So Sherlock Holmes and John Watson, both of them, for the entire series of adventures, know that there are stars in the Strand magazine. It's very self-referential. Holmes is constantly busting Watson's balls over the fact that he's inserted romance into what should have been a series of scientific lectures. And Holmes, since he knows that Watson writes about him for the Strand, it sort of creates the conceit of this grieving friend who has been, in fact, writing about... Hello.
Hello.
Yay! Sorry, it's nice to see you. Yes, anywhere. Oh, you have a pretty copy. I like that one. No, we were just starting. Huzzah! We were talking about Doyle and his penchant for detective murder. So, the fact that the Strand story implies that it happened in 1893, then you've got this sort of perception that Watson's been writing these stories, as I said, for the past 2 years, which is very, very interesting. When it happened, when The Adventure of the Final Problem was released, all sorts of young working men in the city of London, sort of the financial district, and the city of London is just a square mile at the center of London, and the rest of London technically is suburbs of London itself. But people who were going to work in the financial quarter, they were wearing crepe on their hats, black crepe. They were wearing mourning bands. They were devastated, absolutely devastated. There's all kinds of comics devoted to the subject as well. One of them, I think, was published in Punch, and I can pass this around and show it to you. But it was it's a cartoon of a child reading the final problem, aghast, just completely horrified, like, what have you done to my life? This is stone cold on Conan Doyle's part. People were mourning somebody who, you know, they knew theoretically. I've heard that if you take popular quizzes in Great Britain, more people think Sherlock Holmes was a historical figure than they probably should, although I believe he was a historical figure. But the way people reacted to Sherlock Holmes' death was extremely personal. They took it very, very personally. They took it so personally that 20,000 people canceled their Strand magazine subscriptions. So who's the real loser here? Strand, for one. Sherlock Holmes ended up coming out of it fine, as we'll talk about in a sec. But yeah, the Strand readership absolutely plummeted. Conan Doyle said in another letter about being sick of Sherlock Holmes, he said, "I have had such an overdose of him that I feel towards him as I do toward pâté de foie gras, of which I once ate too much, so that the name of it gives me a sickly feeling to this day. I have been much blamed for doing that gentleman to death, but I hold that it was not murder, but justifiable homicide in self-defense, since if I had not killed him, he would certainly have killed me." So, Doyle was just done. He was absolutely done. And he thought that his other writing was much more important. He was an author of historical fiction. He was an author of adventure stories. He was an author of various essays. He was a spiritualist. He wrote all kinds of other things that he thought were much more important than these silly short stories that had, as we spoke of previously, garnered him finally commercial fame. So then in 1897, he needed money. You cannot underestimate the power of needing money when it comes to, like, fantastic commercial writers. This is why I keep comparing Doyle to Shakespeare. They wanted the cheddar, like, but meanwhile the stories were just timeless, absolutely fantastic. So in 1897, Doyle drafted a play about Sherlock Holmes, and that was due to the expenses that had been incurred building a home called Undershaw. And Undershaw, if you would care to learn more about Undershaw, this home is very interesting in that it's the center of a major controversy right now. He wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles at Undershaw. It was a beautiful house that Conan Doyle actually helped to design. He had architectural input into it. And it is currently under threat of being turned into a housing development, as opposed to remaining intact as sort of a historical landmark of a place where, you know, a knight of the realm had been writing some really ferociously cool adventure fiction. So if you want to look up more about Undershaw, the Save Undershaw campaign is very popular at the moment because people don't want Conan Doyle's house to get, that he actually helped design, to get knocked down and turned into, you know, a huge array of kind of anonymous flats, or whatever else could happen to it. But he needed the dollars after he had built that house. So in 1897, he drafted a play about Sherlock Holmes. He had been very, very sick of Holmes. He killed him in 1893, so 4 years later, he's already going back to the Holmes honeypot. So he drafts up a play that didn't actually ultimately get adapted. William Gillette, who was the first major face of Sherlock Holmes. William Gillette was an actor who portrayed Holmes on the stage. He expressed an interest in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, went to Conan Doyle, and then he adapted the short stories into his own work. He asked Conan Doyle, well, how far can I go in adapting Holmes? So we're already adapting Holmes in 1897. We're already turning him into these other things. How can I adapt Holmes? How can I make him something else? How can I make him a commercial enterprise on stage that's effective? So Gillette adapts a number of short stories into a play, and Conan Doyle said, as far as I'm concerned, you can marry him, you can murder him, you can do what you like with him. Because in Doyle's mind, this guy's already dead. I killed that dude. I threw his ass off a waterfall. It's done. It's over between us, between me and Holmes. So Gillette adapts the short stories. He begins performing as Holmes in 1899. And so, as a result, you can see, and I brought this also specifically because it's interesting. So this is the Leslie S. Klinger annotated edition. And both of the cover illustrations are by Frederick Dorr Steele. So the cover illustrations of both of these are directly copying William Gillette's face. Sidney Paget was the original illustrator who we think of very often when we think of Sherlock Holmes, the classic illustrations that occurred in the Strand magazine. But Doris Steele did the illustrations for Collier's, and he based his whole perception of Sherlock Holmes on William Gillette. So some of them look more like William Gillette, some of them look less like William Gillette, but both of these look very, very much like William Gillette. And William Gillette toured around as Sherlock Holmes for quite some time and made a big name for himself doing so, and then got his mug put on tobacco products and all kinds of other stuff that that people thought would be a lucrative enterprise for Sherlock Holmes. So in 1898, Conan Doyle agreed to supervise a hospital in Cape Town, and the Boer War had broken out at this point. And he said, yes, I would like to serve my country, and I would like to go and supervise this hospital in Cape Town for $0. He was paid $0 for this whole enterprise. It was an act of gentlemanly patriotism, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a great guy. So he wanted to serve his country, that's what he did. No money was involved. So in March of 1901, he spoke with the Strand magazine, because he needed money, again, about writing a serialized horror novel about a ghostly dog who haunts the moors of Dartmoor. And it's going to be very, very atmospheric. And it would star Sherlock Holmes. But, he said, but, that doesn't mean Holmes is alive. That means this is about something Holmes and Watson did before he died. It's just going to be this serialized novel. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be a half horror story, half ghost story, half criminal detection thriller. And it is definitely The Hound of the Baskervilles. I don't think it's arguable, and we'll talk about The Hound of the Baskervilles next time, but I think that it's pretty inarguable that that is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's best-known novel. My perception is that it's definitely the best-known. So that one's known everywhere. You think Sherlock Holmes, you think sort of devil hound guy who got rid of the devil hound. So he starts publishing it in serial in the Strand magazine, and the Strand magazine is throwing parades. they're so pleased by this development. They were delighted. Of course they were delighted. It's set before the final problem, though. And Conan Doyle realized that this is screwy. I'm just writing Sherlock Holmes stories at this point that are set before he died. I can do more of these. I have an expanding family. I have expanding expenses. Fine, he's not dead. So in 1903, The Adventure of the Empty House appeared, and in 1903, people rejoiced. There was much rejoicing, there was much brouhaha over the fact that, yes, Sherlock Holmes is back. Which is interesting because you can really tell, I think, and we're going to definitely chat about this, Professor Moriarty only occurs in three cases. He's only mentioned in three cases. He's mentioned in The Final Problem, then he's mentioned in The Adventure of the Empty House, and then later he's mentioned in a novel called The Valley of Fear. It doesn't appear, is only mentioned. So it seems pretty clear that Doyle was just out to murder Holmes and get it done with. And we'll talk about ways that influenced the short story. But notice that Watson, in The Final Problem, which is interesting, he cites actual newspapers like Reuters at the beginning of The Final Problem that are real newspapers that would have reported on Sherlock Holmes' death. Again, in this trope of the story that you were about to hear is completely true. These newspapers reported on my best friend's death. Now I have to go and defend his name against the surviving members of the Moriarty clan. When The Adventure of the Empty House was published, the Strand trumpeted in giant bold letters on the cover, Sherlock Holmes, and then under the words Sherlock Holmes, the story title. And then on the very first page, they said, The Return of Sherlock Holmes, again in like this like shrieking capitals because they're so excited about it. And I'm excited about it too, that he's back. But it's a really interesting duo, The Final Problem and The Empty House. As readers who, and some of you probably have read this before, some of you possibly not, but what was your impression of The Final Problem, first of all, as a short story, and how effective was it for you as a short story?
Well, I think the form was effective, and it was familiar, mm-hmm. so that people liked the continuing serialization of the adventures, were very comfortable with that.
Yes.
So that worked. Believable? You know.
Right?
That was sort of a stretch, I think.
Yeah.
For me, it was a stretch.
How did you find it a stretch?
You know,
and I agree with you, I just want to know how.
Okay. It just seemed to me that very quickly this happened. Overnight, right? Here's a guy who has, all these powers of observation and this incredible intelligence. And it just kind of seemed logical to me that he would put himself in that circumstance unless he wanted it to happen himself. So
that's interesting.
If he was a reflection of Goya, then he wanted. He was, and of course he ignored him and said that was the worst, thing that can befall man. So if he was really bored and he just wanted it over with,
right?
He just like Karen Good did. Well, then this is the way to do that.
That's brilliant. So you think that potentially, and I think potentially this is completely correct, Conan Doyle's boredom actually was leeching into Sherlock Holmes's death wish. That's awesome. Yeah.
I know I'm perfect.
No, that's a meta comment that I am 100% in support of.
I thought it was a really exciting story where they're running away from Moriarty and kind of like knowing that they're being chased, but at the same time, Holmes, where did this guy come from? He's this master criminal and they don't really say what he's actually done. It's like, I know he's behind all these crimes, but what are they?
Agreed, 100%. Is anybody willing to read a paragraph from this? Yeah. Dramatic reading. Richard, is
it? I don't know about that. Okay.
So this is a fun one. It's just that paragraph. Yeah. Thank you, I really appreciate it.
No problem. He's the Napoleon of crime, Watson. He's the organizer of half that is evil and of nearly all that is undetected in this great city. He's a genius, a philosopher, an abstract thinker. He has a brain of the first order. He sits motionlessly, like a spider in the center of its web. But that web has 1,000 radiations, and he knows well every quiver of each of them. He does little himself. He only plans. But his agents are numerous and splendidly organized. Is there a crime to be done, a paper to be abstracted? We will say, a house to be rifled, a man to be removed. The word is passed to the professor. The matter is organized and carried out. The agent may be caught. In that case, money is found for his bail or his defense. But the central power which uses the agent is never caught, never so much as suspected. This was the organization which I detected, or I deduced, Watson, and which I devoted my whole energy to exposing and breaking up.
So he sounds amazing, right? Like, how well written is that paragraph, just in terms of writing? It's amazing. And what makes me crazy, and I'm going to diverge from many Sherlock Holmes scholars, and this is completely my opinion, totally my opinion, and you can take it or leave it, but the structure of the adventure, the final problem, I think is total crap. I think that the way Doyle said about writing it, he's just like, murder, murder, bust, kill, detective. Like, it's egregiously bad. There's a lot of ways in which the adventure of the final problem is how not to write a short story, but the guy's style is so good that you don't even notice. And that's not fair, but I appreciate it. So that paragraph particularly, he's the Napoleon of crime. He orchestrates, what is it, all that is evil and half that is undetected? Or the other way around? It's an amazing quote. So then you start thinking of all these, every crime I've ever seen in the newspaper actually was orchestrated by Professor Moriarty at the center of his web. It's just sitting there. And Conan Doyle has to do practically, he's such a good writer, that he has to do practically no work, like convincing us that Professor Moriarty is awesome. Meanwhile, the way the actual short story is set up is ridiculous. Sherlock Holmes shows up with bloody knuckles at John Watson's house, for no clear reason other than to say, I need you to go to the continent with me because I'd like your life to be in danger, for some reason. It's like, I'd like you to risk your life and come with me to the continent when I could have left you completely alone. Also, by the way, I'd like to leave by your back garden instead of showing Moriarty's agents that I left by the front door, just in case they want to burn down your house. It's ridiculous. And he shows up, and the first thing he practically the first thing he says is, You've never heard of Professor Moriarty, have you? And Watson says, nope. Wrong answer! This is a terrible way to set up a short story. You're trying to set up Professor James Moriarty as not only the Napoleon of crime, but as the archenemy of Sherlock Holmes, and you've set yourself the impossible task of doing it in one short story. And it would have been so easy for Sherlock Holmes to walk into Watson's sitting room and said, you know how I've been fighting Professor Moriarty for like 6 years? And Watson could have been like, totally, dude, what is that bastard doing? It would have been super easy. So I just find it to be very interestingly structured. And they are running from Moriarty the whole time. Do you want to say anything else that struck you about the structure? Because I think that the structure is important.
Well, it's just very strange that they're running away from this guy and you don't really know why. And Watson's just kind of going along with it. Like, all right, whatever. And Holmes also says that he's, like, set him up to have, like, after 3 days or whatever, just to have everyone arrested. But you don't really know how that's happening either or what's going on. And that's going on back in London while they're kind of traipsing through Europe and...
just a lot of traipsing.
Yeah.
A lot of also Holmes going, hey, Watson, pack everything you might need in your luggage and then send it along, and then the train just leaves with their luggage. And meanwhile, it's like, he could have given him a gimme there. Like, okay, pack a dummy set of luggage. That was kind of a dick move. So the quote that I find to be the most telling about this is that, so Holmes says to Watson, I tell you, my friend, that if a detailed account of that silent contest could be written, it would take its place as the most brilliant bit of thrust and parry work in the history of detection. And we're just meant to take his word for it.
Yeah, well, I was having a lot of trouble with it.
Yeah. Good.
No. You were explaining why I was having trouble with it. I came to another conclusion.
Good.
The conclusion I had come to is that I knew so much about it before. This was not my first reading. I mean,
sure.
Professor Moriarty, you say was only in three. I mean, in my mind, he was his evil all through. I mean,
exactly.
In other words, I knew who he was. I knew what he represented, not who he was.
Right.
So I was having a lot of trouble with the story. I also thought that Sherlock Holmes was acting kind of stupid.
Yes,
but then
idiot.
I put those two words in one sentence. But then I blamed that on the fact that I knew that he wasn't dead. You know, in other words,
okay.
I was putting the difficulties of the story, of my reacting to the story, on the fact that I had so much prior knowledge through the years.
Right.
But listening to you, I now agree with you.
It's just bad. No, I don't. And I'm such a disgraceful Sherlockian for, like, holding this opinion, and I rant about it constantly. But so, yes, we know now that he's alive, right, after the fact. That doesn't really make it clear how Conan Doyle managed to, and that's why I wanted you to read that paragraph. Thank you for reading that paragraph. Conan Doyle is such a magician, in my opinion, that even though he wrote a story in which John Watson, so you've got this first-person narrator in John Watson. John Watson, by this time, and I think you'll have noticed this, because we talked about the relationship between Holmes and Watson last time. By this time, they're very close, right? I mean, this is a person who I would stand in front of a bullet for you, dude, if it came to that. On both of their parts, I think. Which is another reason this story makes no sense. But he says that his very intimate relations with Sherlock Holmes led him they drifted apart after he got married, and he wasn't involved in as many cases, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't still intimately involved with Holmes whenever Holmes needed him to be involved in the solving of crime. So then you've got this perfect narrator set up, and Doyle just really was kicking sandcastles here. He's built this beautiful, beautiful sandcastle of this crime-solving duo who work like a house on fire. And we're watching Doyle stomp on it, in essence, without any regard for what he's doing, because his goal was to kill Sherlock Holmes at this point. Again, I'm not this traditional Sherlockian viewpoint on the quality of the story, the final problem. But when we hear that paragraph out loud, Doyle was such a master of prose that the impression that's then created in your mind is yes, Sherlock Holmes, of course, his arch nemesis is Professor Moriarty. You buy it. You actually eat what he's feeding you, which is a little bit remarkable, I think. I think it's remarkable that if Sherlock Holmes says to John Watson, you probably never heard of Professor Moriarty, my total arch nemesis, who's super evil, and then Watson says, nope. The world building is weird there. So, can you guys point out, and I think you probably can, whether you like the Warner Brothers adaptation or not, or whether you like the BBC Sherlock adaptation or not, in what ways does it change the story for the better?
I think the BBC adaptation handled it so well because they made Moriarty this like, evil character from the beginning, where he was always kind of in the background, kind of made up for what's missing in the story. So you have like the whole first season and the second season where he's in the background.
It's day one, he's there. In A Study in Pink, which is based on A Study in Scarlet, almost directly based on A Study in Scarlet, but there he is, orchestrating. And not everyone, and I completely understand why this would be true, not everyone likes the Warner Brothers adaptations. I like them tremendously, but because I like explosions and I hate trees, so I like watching trees explode. But that adaptation also, Guy Ritchie's adaptation, first film. Do you see Moriarty? Not really. Is he there? Yeah. He's organizing evil. He's organizing undetected things. So he is masterminding the whole Lord Blackwood deal. And Irene Adler, the Rachel McAdams character in the Warner Brothers films, is very, very frightened of Professor Moriarty in the first film. And then she's actually, maybe, maybe not, because I'm not convinced she's actually deceased. I hope she isn't. But she is fridged. she's murdered in order to create an emotional reaction from Sherlock Holmes in the second film, Game of Shadows. So it's always about Moriarty in the new adaptations. To what extent do you think that's because Conan Doyle didn't plan to bring Holmes back?
Am I right in saying, like, there is no body at the end of the final? So I just wonder if he always gave himself that room as to come back if you need, you know. So I always thought that now, you know, and again, you have the luxury of hindsight, having knowing that he's alive. But when you go back and read it, you see he really did give himself plenty of room.
He gave himself plenty of room.
Oh yeah.
I mean, so I think he just needed a break from Sherlock Holmes, and he wrote this little sort of section here.
And he wanted it in 1891, and he didn't actually give it to himself until 1893. So yeah, by then he was definitely sick and tired of it.
I think I know that I am influenced by the article in the New Yorker on Hilary Mantel, and particularly writing Wolf Hall. I have both Wolf Hall and the other bodies, and I'm finding them a real struggle.
Sure. The temperature just has to drop.
But she says herself, quote, is that when she's writing Wolf Hall, she knows this is what she was meant to do. This is her destiny. This is what she was meant to do. And I think Conan Doyle always imagined he had a destiny. And this Sherlock Holmes stuff got in his way. And he became more and more resentful of that in each episode. You can see he doesn't like his character. I mean, Holmes is not a person that's very likable. I mean, how anyone could care about him is amazing to me. I wish the book.
Well, you've only got one guy, basically.
Yeah,
he does.
Descriptions of him, like, oh my God.
Well, you've got a population of one who's devoted to it.
Watson, to me, is a much more interesting character.
Watson's fascinating.
I mean, Holmes is a blank slate. I mean, this guy is, he's brilliant, but, which is a good thing, but that's all he's got. He just doesn't care about anybody. He's, I find it hard to believe he's even seeking justice. He's just seeking to satisfy his own ego.
Sure, sure. So the boredom motivation for you comes through. Yeah. That his brain is too noisy, so what he needs to do is find problems. Give me problems, give me cryptograms, give me you know, work. Right, and it comes across as selfish.
Yeah. But I really thought, as I continued to read through, that it was very, very frustrating. And, you know, it plays out, and I think some of Holmes is like him. I mean, he's rejecting himself.
I think that that's very apt. And I think that it is sort of circular. That you have this character who, in some ways, is self-defeating, and in some ways, is, you know, could live maybe much more happily if he changed some of his habits. And meanwhile, Doyle considered himself specifically, explicitly, to be shackled to Sherlock Holmes. And just, this is something that I write because I need a paycheck, which is unfortunate. But which it also gave us a great many more Sherlock Holmes mysteries, which is, in my opinion, awesome. I think that the question of Holmes and empathy is worth talking about, and not necessarily in the sense that I don't think that he lacks empathy if you use deductive reasoning on him. Some of his motivations, if you think to yourself, okay, why would you do that exactly? And we'll talk about In Hound of the Baskervilles next time. Specifically in Hound, he sends Watson off to Dartmoor to investigate this whole business with Sir Henry, and Sir Henry is meant to be protected by Watson, and Watson's meant to send telegrams back to Holmes. He's meant to write letters back to Holmes that will be delivered to him very quickly, and he's going to stay behind in London and solve crime. So Watson does this, and right before Watson agrees to do this, and right before Watson leaves for Dartmoor, Holmes says, I have serious reservations about sending you out on this mission, and I want you to know that. And then about 4 days later, Holmes shows up in a cave on the moor. So I think that there are things that he does care about, but I think that he keeps them under an enormously tight... He's under iron control of himself throughout the series, with very few exceptions. The exceptions are pretty much The Adventure of the Devil's Foot and The Adventure of the Three Garadebs, which are famous among Sherlockians for being times when Holmes lost it, which is great. But in the absence of John Watson, the series wouldn't work. No. And I think you've identified that very sharply. It wouldn't be interesting.
No.
Without John Watson. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And you've got a very emotionally invested foil and narrator in John Watson.
So that appeals to me, that it's not Holmes that's like gushing forth all these emotions, that it's really Watson. And so, you know, for me, that's one of the things I found appealing about the character. I think if it was written the other way, where Holmes all of a sudden you knew everyone, you know, knew all his emotions, it's like, I don't know.
Well, then you couldn't have Watson being the character.
Right.
Yeah.
So you haven't had the right combination.
The quote that I think, and you're exactly right, that's one of the reasons I love this series so much, is that you have basically the brains of the operation, and then you have the hot, thumping heart of the operation, right? And I think that Sherlock Holmes, as a man, in several cases, he is extremely invested in seeing justice done. In other ones, as you said, he's just bored and could not care less about the outcome of the actual case. So from Fan Fiction, the essay that you read by Michael Chabon, I think the sentence that really sums that up is when he says, "The series was perfected by an archetypal pair who have only Quixote and Sancho as rivals in the hearts of readers and in the annals of imaginary friendship, that record of wildly limited men who find in each other, and only in each other, the stuff, sense, and passion of one whole man." And I think basically Sherlock Holmes and John Watson are two halves of one functioning adult British male, basically. John Watson would probably be okay if he had never... He would probably have worked through the issues of recovering from the Afghan War without Sherlock Holmes. Probably. Maybe not as quickly. Maybe finding a battlefield with Sherlock Holmes really helped him to recover from coming back from the Afghan War. But I don't think Sherlock Holmes would have been half the man he was if he hadn't met John Watson. So the month before The Empty House was announced, a month before The Empty House was released, The Strand magazine trumpeted in their previous issue, "Fortunately, the news of Sherlock Holmes' death, though based on circumstantial evidence, which at the time seemed conclusive, turns out to be erroneous." So again, you've got the story you were about to hear is completely true. So moving to the empty house from the final problem, and now knowing the context that Doyle just really had homicide on his mind when he was writing the final problem, how did the empty house hold up as a short story?
I, again, didn't understand what was so bad about these people that he was running from them for 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, if you knew Moriarty was dead, why did you need to hide for 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
That didn't really make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense. Okay, particularly, it doesn't make sense when you remember that in the final problem, he has gotten a telegram from Scotland Yard indicating that they've secured the entire gang with the exception of Moriarty.
And then suddenly, they've secured everyone except for Moran, and then also a couple others. Like.
And then also these other dudes who are really dangerous, I promise. Right. It doesn't hold a lot of water. So regarding your general impression, and I think that that's very apt, that Moriarty is the arch-nemesis of Sherlock Holmes, did the empty house read as problematically for you as the final problem?
No. No, I sort of read that separately. I didn't really necessarily connect the, you know, connect the two. It was a separate story.
Yeah. They're interesting in that in some ways they're completely separate, and in some ways they're two halves of what happened in Switzerland. So, for instance, he's giving explanations like, I suddenly realized what an opportunity it would be for me to be dead, and I needed money, so I told my brother about it. But, I'm sorry, bestie, I decided that you probably cared too much about me to know. I don't know that there's any... It's an emotional roller coaster, particularly in the sense that, like, these books ostensibly are about two people who are fighting crime in a very scientific manner for the time period, right? So they're using a lot of science, which is awesome. They're using a lot of forensic techniques that were not necessarily developed at the time period. Fingerprints weren't even admissible in a court of law during this time. So you still had people who were studying phrenology, for instance, which is determining a person's moral intelligence, their character, their behavioral proclivities, based on the bumps in their skull. There's a lot of phrenology going on in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. You see it at the beginning of The Hound of Baskervilles. You see it in several cases. You see it at the beginning of The Blue Carbuncle, which we read last time, where Holmes says, the man is intelligent who lost this hat. And Watson's like, why? And Holmes says, because the man with a head this big has to have something in it. That's not actually true. it's a percentage of your... It's what percentage of your brain you actually use that makes a difference, not how large your brain is. In cubic capacity, which is what he calls it. It is a question of cubic capacity. But, yeah.
No, I just realized, though, I read The Empty House before I read the final.
Oh, yeah.
When I said I saw them as two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have all the information in the back of my head from years ago.
Of course, yeah.
But in terms of just the fresh reading, is I don't know, maybe that's why I just did not connect.
Yeah, and I had said to read them in the wrong order like 6 times in a row.
I know you did. No, it was in this book. Yeah. The final promise wasn't. So what I did is I read the stories that were in the book, and then I got the source feed.
Off the internet because they're public domain. That's the perfect solution. Thank you for doing that. Yeah, I don't know that reading The Empty House after or before the final problem would... That's intriguing to me. I don't know if it would make a difference. They make no sense. Neither of them, I don't think.
There's so many gaps.
Yeah.
It seemed like they were just hastily done. You know, like, oh, I'm tired of them. Let me get rid of them. Crap, I need the money. Let me bring them back. And, you know, obviously he's a good, he's talented, but it really did seem like it was just, because, I mean, when I was reading The Final Problem, you had, you know, again, this is today's day, he's such a legendary character. And it's like, in a paragraph, he's gone. Just like, you know. I thought there'd be a bigger build-up or bigger fanfare, something more elaborate than, well, I didn't see it going, and there's a little piece of note under a rock.
Rock. Brilliant, yeah. John Watson never speaks to Professor Moriarty once. This is another thing that we talked about when we talked about Irene Adler. you are almost inhibited by Watson's perspective in a number of short stories because he is listening to someone give him almost third-hand information at times. So in the case of having read this, I think, brilliant essay by Chabon, he talks about the layers that exist in these stories. So you've got Watson starting with the story you're about to hear is true, it exists in the real world, we're published in the Strand magazine and we know about it. We're famous. And then next, you've got somebody coming to Baker Street saying, I have a problem. It's a weird problem. And they're reporting what the problem is through the eyes of Dr. Watson. Then often they give an account of something someone else said happened. Like Dr. Mortimer at the beginning of The Hound of the Baskervilles is reporting on even things other people said happened. So there are so many layers of sort of human filtration that the facts are going through in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries that it can be very, very hard to get at the nuts and bolts of the matter. And I think that James Moriarty as a character, if Conan Doyle hadn't been the writer who was able to pull off that paragraph specifically in The Final Problem, I think is brilliant. The Napoleon of crime, the spider at the center of his web, all this stuff. The imagery is so alive, right? He's so good that I want to punch him retroactively because he's breaking all the rules of the ways to actually set this up. He's not setting up an antagonistic relationship in the way that you traditionally would. In fact, he's going completely against all of it. And then, as you said, in The Empty House, Sherlock Holmes comes back. So what part of his explanation, which I think is hilarious, and I'm just going to share with you, because I think it's so funny. Apparently Holmes is a ninja, right? It's great. I love Sherlock Holmes. There's nothing he can't do. So you've got, apart from be polite to you and maybe express emotional, normalcy. So in addition to being a master of observation and a master of all this other stuff, deductive reasoning, he's a genius, his brain is the size of the continent of Australia. He's also a ninja. So Conan Doyle wrote the word baritsu, which is a misspelling of the word bartitsu, when Holmes explains that, yeah, I know that you thought I was dead, but actually I wrestled Professor Moriarty off this clifftop, and I could only accomplish actually winning against an elderly mathematics professor, me, young, middle-aged, fit, I can unbend steel pokers if necessary, but it took my ninja skills to fight an elderly mathematics professor off the side of a cliff. Bartitsu is specifically, it's like a Japanese style of self-defense that was popular at the time, and it was created by a British guy, and his name was E.W. Barton Wright, and so Bartitsu is actually kind of a corruption between Barton and Jiu-Jitsu. So E.W. Barton Wright spends 3 years in Japan, and he thinks that jiu-jitsu is an amazing martial art, which it is. It's fierce. And Conan Doyle is presented with the problem of explaining how Sherlock Holmes actually didn't die at this very, very tall waterfall. And he comes up with bartitsu as a get-out-of-jail-free card. So it's a weaponless system of self-defense. It emphasizes temporarily yielding to an opponent, which I think is interesting, and then crippling or killing that opponent through holds or blows or throws. And I'm grateful to Leslie Esclair for this information because he has a whole little section on bartitsu in his annotated. It's basically, like, if you were to imagine an Englishman staying in Japan for a bit, it's jiu-jitsu with added boxing and wrestling. And that's awesome, and I have mad respect for that, but it was invented 8 years after The Final Problem was supposed to have been written. So this is another example of Conan Doyle just being like, he's a ninja. Whatever. I'm just gonna throw this in there, because bartitsu didn't exist when Sherlock Holmes fought Professor Moriarty. The Wrecking Ball. False. It's implied when Watson talks about his bereavement. Did you guys catch that part in The Empty House?
Dead wife.
Presumably. Did anyone think it might be something else? Dead wife is the most common explanation.
It's strange to have such a throwaway line. That's obviously very significant, but not elaborate on it.
That is weird to me, too. Not that they would necessarily have a long conversation about it. It's generally assumed that Mary Morstan, who Watson met in the Sign of Four and married, and is married to, throughout the course of the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. It's assumed that Mary Morstan somehow passed away. So, picture John Watson's life for those 3 years. That's not so good, right? He, in terms of a narrator, and another reason I think that people build all these worlds and all these spin-offs due to the death of Sherlock Holmes is that it's an extraordinarily cruel action in retrospect. And when you think about Watson, who is not only devoted to this crime solver, who he knows to be brilliant and to be on the side of justice, he loses his best friend, he loses his wife, very shortly thereafter. So I think that I'm interested, for instance, to see how they're actually going to deal with that in the new adaptations. Because in the Warner Brothers version of Sherlock Holmes, I think actually Mary Morstan is one of the coolest parts of those. She's sassy. She's got a lot of sass. She's played by Kelly Reilly in the Warner Brothers films, and she's perfectly alive and well at the end of Game of Shadows, when you see that Holmes is actually, in fact, alive. We have no idea what's going to happen in the BBC version, where John isn't married at the end of the second series, but could very well be married by the time Sherlock Holmes decides to come back. So basically, these modern adaptations, and the point I'm trying to make here, is that when Michael Chabon talks about the gaps, was that resonant for you guys? When he speaks of the gaps in the narrative and how that is part of what makes people step up and write more stories. Have any of you ever encountered like a series of stories or a poet or anyone really that, you know, sometime before you turned 20, like you just wrote something that was a complete ripoff of that style? Did you ever have the urge to like make something based in something that already existed?
Question, no.
Yeah, not everyone does.
That was not an urge I've ever had.
which is, you know, like let's be honest here, not everybody does, for sure. Which is why I find it crazy, not crazy, wonderful, amazing, that I have this statistic here. If you look at the two largest fiction archives on the internet, there are over 38,000 stories that are based just in the world of BBC Sherlock. So, there are a lot of people who take these gaps in the narrative that I think Chabon writes about very eloquently when he brings in Joseph Conrad and the age of exploration and how it's very difficult to think of a world at this point that hasn't been explored. So, sometimes people instead create worlds in a fantasy genre that can then be explored to their heart's content. Sometimes people go back to worlds like this one, where there are things that make no sense. And they try to sort of retroactively fix it. And his argument also, when he talks about the Baker Street Irregulars, so I'll talk about them for a second. I'm a proud member of the Baker Street Irregulars. First, I was a member of the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes. And the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes was created in the 60s as a result of the women not being invited to be in the Baker Street Irregulars, despite the fact that women are really hardcore Sherlockians. These sort of societies exist, I think, to an enormous extent because of Doyle's backtracking. He created this hero who is really not a hero, that's wrong. He created a pair of people who operate as a really effective crime-solving team, and what they're having is adventures. Chabon points this out as well. It's not cases. It's running from demon hounds and secret societies and all that stuff. So he creates this pair, and then he breaks it apart about halfway through what would ultimately end up being the whole collection. And you've suddenly got all these crazy Jungian Joseph Campbell hero mythology themes coming into it. I mean, the hero dies and then is resurrected, and then after the hero is resurrected, he's come back from the underworld having defeated his nemesis, and then he almost did this by accident. He wrote these short stories that don't make a great deal of sense if you're just staring at them topically, but then if you look at them heroically, mythologically, and how they resonate with people, almost by accident, he did a really good thing by killing Holmes and bringing him back. Because a lot of people are really interested in talking about heroic self-sacrifice after that. I'll just read quickly one passage from The Empty House that I think sums all of that up. Watson says, "It was indeed like old times when I found myself seated beside him in a hansom, my revolver in my pocket, and the thrill of adventure in my heart." That's about the size of it. So now they're back together, as they ought to be, fighting crime. Holmes then calls Baker Street, right after that, the starting point of Watson's, quote, little fairy tales, end quote. He's not far off. I mean, to what extent do you think they might be fairy tales more than crime stories?
The methodology itself is otherworldly,
mm-hmm.
the powers.
Powers, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, yes. He's almost a superhero in some ways.
Well, it's also on a level that is not really realistic in terms of whatever the particular thing that he's solving is way up here somewhere because of some obscure knowledge that he has that most people would not have.
Yes.
So in that way, it is a fairy tale.
And the cases themselves are so extraordinary, like with that mm-hmm. speckled band that's trained to go into the next room and kill somebody.
I completely agree with Holmes's remark there. And I think you're right. I think that okay, so who in their right mind doesn't just shove somebody in front of a speeding carriage as opposed to training a snake to crawl up, you know, through an air vent, down a bell pole, and then maybe kill this girl, maybe not. night after night after night. I mean, that's not efficient, but it's great. Like, it's so much fun to read, so...
And you have things like Moran with his, like, incredible sniper skills.
Yes!
An impossible gun that only he has, and you have a super serum that gives an old man strength and half turns him into a monkey.
It's completely fanciful, a lot of it, which I think is what makes it fantastic. So, regarding Chapin's essay, briefly, to what extent do you guys think that Sherlock Holmes is openly mocking speaks exactly to what you were referring to. To what extent is Holmes mocking Sir Arthur Conan Doyle when he mocks Watson, dude? I mean, some of that is tongue-in-cheek. I think some of it was a coping mechanism.
I think some of it is tongue-in-cheek, but some of it is malicious.
He's putting down the stories because he didn't like them himself.
Well, actually, Sherlock Holmes needs Watson more than Watson needs Sherlock Holmes.
And I think it's really funny how you've got this guy who is mocking them for being fairy tales at the same time that they really are. They really are romances, and Holmes is right, but Doyle finds them trivial, and so Holmes is going to find them trivial. There's a lot of stuff to parse in there, and you're right. I think that he had such reservations by the time he went back to it that he couldn't help but get a little snarkier. So Chapin says the Holmes stories are constructed around a series of gaps, and you've got these absences, right, where things make no sense whatsoever. For that reason, and not only for that reason, I think it also has to do with just the emotional connection that you have in the friendship. You have this very profound emotional connection between Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, where they have this amazing life. Like if you were to suddenly ask yourself, what would be a cool life? Well, I'd like to have a best friend who's a genius, and we fight crime together, and the crimes are awesome, and I basically don't have to do anything except for show up and bring the gun, and watch him be amazing the whole time. I would sign up for that, like, gangbusters.
But you don't only watch him being amazing, you have to let him know.
Yes!
You have to let him know.
That's true! Yes, you have to let him know he's amazing at the same time. Because he will appreciate that and allow you to stay longer. I can't imagine a cooler scenario than having a best friend who is an independent crime solver who invites you to go with him. So there's that. There's that magical element of it. But there's also the magical element, of course, of the fact that these two people, as Chapin, with the quote that I mentioned earlier, they're basically two halves of something that works. They don't work in absence of each other. There are two Sherlock Holmes cases that are written by Sherlock Holmes from his narrative perspective. they tend to start out whinging about how Watson isn't there. And the Adventure of the Blanched Soldier and the Adventure of the Lion's Mane. And they have a point, because when Holmes is speaking as the narrator, he admits that there are a lot of ways in which Watson was able to hold things back in terms of seeing facts or making conclusions that Holmes is not able to hold back when he is writing about himself. And there's a very palpable loss there that Watson's not there to help him with these particular cases. That's part of it. But the gaps are another part of it.
Do you think the gaps were done on purpose?
Some of them, yes.
Yeah.
Specifically, the ones where he throws out these tantalizing cases where you're just, oh, I want it. Like, the case of the giant rat of Sumatra, for which the world is not yet prepared. Like, I couldn't possibly talk about this, guys. It's too much for you. Like, Holmes and I ended the giant rat of Sumatra. That's all I'm going to give you. Look, I can't disclose it. It's hilarious. That's completely deliberate. That's another thing that Doyle was really, really good at, was throwing out these... So now there's a gap in my knowledge, because I don't have the giant rat story. But Doyle completely fabricated that.
I almost feel, though, that Doyle probably had it in a drawer somewhere. And
yeah.
When he needed it, he was going to pull it out and say, well, here's the...
Yes!
Here's the rat.
Please tell me where that drawer is, because I want it so bad. And then he mentions it's even worse than that. Yeah, so we probably did have this sort of cache of ideas that he didn't necessarily draw from because it wasn't the right time, or he didn't have the right idea, or he had a better idea, that sort of thing. So then you've got this battered, apparently in the vaults of Cox & Co. Bank in London, John Watson says that there is a battered tin dispatch box filled with cases of Sherlock Holmes, and if anybody were to open this dispatch box, crazy shit would go down. And it's so mean, because if you really get into the series, then you want to read about all of those things. And whole societies are formed, as I was saying about the adventuresses and the Baker Street Irregulars. There are entire societies that exist just to talk about them, because we have bought it hook, line, and sinker, and we'll write pastiches, we'll write fan fiction, we'll make up the rest of the world so that we can have it in front of us. Yeah. Please.
Right.
Please interrupt me at any time.
Do you
and
think
frequently.
That was even that, he went to that extent saying, well, this will continue on, I'm giving somebody a form or an opportunity to continue on the stories after I pass, almost from vanity? Like, if I create this other, like, in the bank, there's a vault, you know,
yeah.
All these stories.
You know, it's a great question, because he was definitely aware that it was going to happen, because it happened very quickly.
Yeah, because it happened in, yeah.
It happened so, so quickly. There were people who were doing parodies of Sherlock Holmes when Sherlock Holmes had only existed for a few years, like 3 years, I think, was when the first parody of Sherlock Holmes was produced in 1890, something like that. I could look that up. We talked about it last time. But the fact that people were going to be adapting Holmes was extremely clear to Doyle immediately. And he was completely okay with it. He wanted a stake in the profits because he deserved it.
Well,
so,
and I'm just,
yeah.
Economically, now he's going to get all these other mm-hmm. people writing, which he doesn't like, obviously, writing the stories.
Right.
But he likes the money coming in from the stories.
It's a cash cow.
He recognized very early that he hit something.
The guy was an entrepreneur. I love the fact that he was an entrepreneur. I think you're right. I don't know that necessarily he was leaving these gaps in the narrative deliberately to try to recruit people to write more of the stories that didn't have to be him. But definitely, whenever somebody wanted to adapt the stories, he was very open to that. Like, as with the Gillette play, in which he said, I don't care what you do with Sherlock Holmes, just pay me. like, it's fine. And he knew that it was going to have a lot of cross-pollination. He was clever enough that when he was writing Hound of the Baskervilles, he knew for a fact that it was going to ramp up sales of the collection of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Because suddenly Sherlock Holmes was going to be in the Strand magazine again, so now I'm going to sell more copies of the collected adventures from before Sherlock Holmes was dead. So, yes, he was very aware of all of the ways in which the proliferation of the character could be of benefit to him. And of benefit to anybody who appreciates the series and the characters themselves. some of it is just brilliant world building. I do think that to some extent the world building that he was doing was extraordinary. You've got the giant rat of Sumatra. You've got my favorite, I think, of all time, and I haven't tackled this particular pastiche yet. I will one day. Is the story that they can't tell you about of the politician, the lighthouse, and the trained cormorant? And you're like, what? Like, what could have been going on with a politician, a lighthouse, and a diving bird that can swallow stuff? Like, but it's amazing. And I really want it to exist. I write stories, pastiches for the Strand magazine, the American Strand magazine, and I have one coming out in the winter issue, and this is going to be, I think, the fifth or sixth one that I've written for them. But I tend to base them around these ones that are mentioned and that are not explicated fully. And I started when I was at the ripe age of like 7 or 8, like writing really bad imitations of Sherlock Holmes stories. Terrible. Like, not good. And Shaman talks about doing that too. And I think that Shaman has a soft spot in his heart for hero stories and adventure stories, and I think that's kind of nice. So then you read two adventures that took place after Holmes had died and come back. They're very much on the opposite spectrum of quality, and part of the reason you read both of those was because of Neil Gaiman's piece, which I think is phenomenal and amazing, and was nominated for a bunch of awards this last year. And I thought that it would be important for you to sort of get context for that story. But first of all, Bruce Partington Plans is one of my favorites. And what did you think of it? Did that one go over fairly well? Body on the roof of the train one?
I just love Mycroft. So.
Mycroft's awesome.
Yeah.
It's good to have him expanded as a character.
I don't know what's so fascinating about Mycroft, but he really is like an intriguing character.
Is it because you have such a build-up that you appreciate the character Sherlock and all his extraordinary powers, and all of a sudden Mycroft comes in and you feel like he's the older brother, and he's just...
That much more.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in TV Tropes, even. TV Tropes has an entry for the smarter older brother. and he's very, very interesting, and he's also one of the only things that grounds Sherlock Holmes in the corporeal universe, literally. Sherlock Holmes could have sprung fully formed from the head of Zeus, like, except for the fact that he has this brother, who's also a weirdo.
I think he's even weirder than...
Yeah! I don't think anyone's arguing that point with you. He's a weird dude.
Which also creates more holes in the map, because then you wonder, what was their childhood like?
Yeah. He's
such a brilliant, insane genius.
No, I wondered what their parents
were. That's
what
I mean.
Right.
Has anyone ever taken that up to talk about it?
Yeah.
They have.
Yeah, and it's an endlessly fascinating topic because Holmes says nothing about his upbringing. He implies that he's part French. He implies that he says that his ancestors were country squires. It's years after Watson meets him that Holmes takes him to meet his brother in the first place, which is ridiculous. So he first appears in the Greek Interpreter, and then he appears in Bruce Partington Plans to enormously cool effect, I think, because he's just a neat character.
Well, that one line, right, where he's the British government, that's a great line.
It's a fantastic line, and Doyle, again, punches for Conan Doyle, because that's not really set up. It's not set up in the Greek Interpreter, it's the exact same thing that he does in The Final Problem. Where he says he's the Napoleon of crime, and you're like, of course he is! I believe you! Like, and then with Mycroft Holmes, like, I was lying to you about my brother being in civil service before. He kind of is the British government, pretty much. And you're like, oh my god, Mycroft Holmes is the British government! But like, you completely believe him. Because it's just that good writing. The body on the train thing, I think, is awesome. And you got all the best peripheral characters. You've got Lestrade, you've got Mycroft, you've got Holmes and Watson, housebreaking. Always satisfying. They love breaking into people's houses. It's like their favorite thing. They get a real kick out of it. Particularly in The Adventure of Charles Augustus Milverton, which is a classic case. But so is Bruce Partington. It's classic. And it's just really a cool clue. The guy has no ticket, or yeah, the guy on the roof with the ticket, and then there's the ticket problem, there's the lack of blood problem, there's all these clues, and then wait a second, one of these agents lives at a place where a train might conceivably stop under the window. Like, all of it is plausible, I think. It's a little far-fetched, but it's like, it's plausible. All of this could have happened. And then you have the adventure of the creeping man and monkey serum. So how'd that one go down?
I had watched the Granada adaptation of that one recently, and kind of at the end of it was like, what
just happened to my face?
And reading it, I was still like, I don't understand what is going on here. I think if I had just read it and I hadn't even seen that,
the Granada one's like hallucinogenic.
Yeah, like it kind of, yeah. It doesn't explain it, but it attempts to. This is just in the last paragraph, it's like, oh, he half turned into a monkey.
I did not come up with monkey syrup, but somewhere in the middle of the story, I started thinking of Viagra.
Okay, you nailed it.
I honestly did.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Because they made a point that he was involved with a much younger woman.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm glad Viagra doesn't have that side effect in the modern universe. That one verges on the sci-fi, and a couple of them do. I think that one to an enormous extent, and probably to a greater extent than most. Even you have the adventure, for instance, of the Sussex vampire, which is also a very late case in which they think that there is a vampire, and there really is not a vampire. There's a perfectly logical explanation, but the monkey serum is kind of a long walk. So then you've got this long walk. And you had the introduction to Mycroft, and then Neil Gaiman comes along with a short story from Holmes's perspective. How did that go for you?
That was fabulous.
Isn't it good?
Yeah. I read it at work.
Yeah. Are there particular ways you enjoyed that it played off the creeping man? Because it kind of is.
Yeah.
It's an magnificent example of it, sort of. Retconning, going back and fixing mistakes.
Yes. It's a total retcon. And in a really good way, I think. So I found myself a little disoriented when I read it the first time, because I'm like, who is this guy keeping bees? This old Chinese dude.
Yeah, I didn't really understand who was speaking for the first little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't really clear.
But then once you find out, it's not that.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
It was great structure because that first introductory paragraph makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Whatsoever.
And then after I finished it, I went back and reread it. And I was like, oh my god. It was just so brilliantly forces you to go back and look at what you've already been told.
So not only is it a retcon of the creeping man, but it's a retcon of the initial paragraph that you don't understand. where you then go back and figure it out.
I got hung up on page 169, the second paragraph.
Uh-huh.
The line. The son who had killed her. The son who had killed her lived for a week and died himself. I just thought that was kind of, it was a little on the rough side.
It was rough. Yeah, he hasn't had a particularly blessed life. Which is one of the reasons, and I found that to be a very rough moment as well. He's had a very tragic life, and then at the end, he finds the leftovers of Holmes's longevity serum that has been largely, you know, just sort of kept by Holmes, but this is the dregs of it. He decides that he's going to prolong his life with the bees still further, which I think is very, very interesting. Because Holmes's argument in The Creeping Man, and one which Gaiman claims in Case of Death and Honey, Holmes planted, Holmes says to Watson, you need to put a part in about how nobody spiritual would want to prolong their life for an indefinite period. It would be survival of the least fit. He seems to have come around to a complete reversal of opinion by the time you get to the Case of Death and Honey, because at this point, he's investing himself, and specifically, he plans to go back and find Watson with the ability to theoretically live as long as they like.
I thought the whole thing with Mycroft was that still.
Me too. Yeah.
And I love the fact that he can't get out the door.
They're luring him out like a piano. Oh, God, I know.
I thought it was interesting how he says that Mykov's death was the end of empire, because doesn't the timing kind of coincide with the actual end of the Victorian period? And that
the timing dovetails really nicely.
Yeah.
And it plays with that part of the original canon where he explains that Mycroft pretty much is the British government. So then when you lose Mycroft, you've lost something beyond a figurehead. You've lost something beyond an administration. You've lost the guy who is keeping it together. Neil has one other Sherlock Holmes short story that is well worth reading and very different from this one. So this one is all sort of grounded in the original Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and it's a little fantastical in that he comes up with the solutions to eternal life, but it's like for science, you know? So it kind of fits into the universe the way Doyle created it. His other Sherlock Holmes short story is in a collection called Shadows Over Baker Street, and it is called A Study in Emerald and is a crossover between Sherlock Holmes and H.P. Lovecraft. So you've got Sherlock Holmes existing in this world where, you know, the elder gods are also there and all of the Lovecraftian horror elements are at play. But Neil's a really extraordinary writer and completely pulls it off. As long as you've got the original characters resembling themselves sufficiently. And Neil's a genuine fan, so it's really easy for him to pull that off because he loves the original. Then you can add any sort of element to it that you want, and it's still Sherlock Holmes.
I have another fun example in which it actually helped me figure out Case of Death and Honey early on, because there was a Batman issue in which Batman met Sherlock Holmes. It was on the 100th anniversary of Sherlock Holmes. The writer's like, well, we want Sherlock Holmes to still be alive. How can we do that? Special bee pollen that he discovered effects of honey, and so Batman meets 100-year-old Sherlock Holmes.
It's too cool.
And so it's like these two great detectives meeting, and it's true. There's this constant.
Was that in the comic series?
Yeah, it was in the Detective Stories. So there's this constant need to have Sherlock Holmes meet all sorts of figures.
He meets the whole roster of everybody. He meets in The 7% Solution by Nicholas Meyer. He meets Sigmund Freud. In later books by Nicholas Meyer, he meets the Phantom of Bloody Opera and Bram Stoker. In another Sherlock Holmes pastiche, he meets Oscar Wilde in Sherlock Holmes and the Mysterious... I forget what the title of that one is. The Mysterious Friend of Oscar Wilde, I think. In my pastiche novel, Dust and Shadow, he fights Jack the Ripper. There's no end to this, and there's no end to possibilities of ways that you can take the character and expand on him, as we've been saying, partly because the relationship between he and Watson is so compelling and so charming, but partly also because Conan Doyle didn't bother checking his own dates or fact-checking any of his own material. Did you guys, and I asked this right before you came in, did you watch Elementary? So I want to know what everyone thought of Elementary if you watched it on CBS.
I liked it. I mean, you got to be open to it. Definitely. Is it the first time that a female is introduced as Watson?
I'm so glad you asked that. No. And CBS has been lying to everyone. Insane. Some of their social media has made the implication, I shouldn't say that they've been lying. Some of their social media has made the implication that she is the first female Watson. She's not. There was a very famous argument made at a Baker Street Irregulars dinner back in the day by a gentleman named Rex Stout, in which he wrote an entire article, very tongue-in-cheek, called Watson Was a Woman, in which he argues that Watson, in order to put up with the levels of, like, titanium-level crap that he put up with for Sherlock Holmes, must have been married to the man. So the Watson Was a Woman article was infamous in the Baker Street Irregulars. That was one of the first mentions of Watson possibly being female. Then you had a very short-lived, it might have been a made-for-TV movie, I'm not sure, but CBS themselves have done a female Watson previously. And there's the film They Might Be Giants, in which Joanne Woodard plays, I think, Dr. Mildred Watson, and in They Might Be Giants, Sherlock Holmes is actually a guy named Justin Playfair, which is a very heroic name, and he's sort of a Don Quixote figure. It's less of a Sherlock Holmes adaptation, even though he has the cap, he has the deerstalker, he has the pipe, etc., he has all the iconography. But it's really a Don Quixote story in that he believes that he is the great detective and that he has to right wrongs and fight crime. And he's actually certifiably crazy. And his psychiatrist becomes increasingly, whose name is Dr. Watson, so of course she needs to help him solve crime, he decides. So she increasingly helps him and falls into the fancy. She becomes more of a Sancho Panza figure. And so they're Holmes and Watson, they're Quixote, and they're all kinds of cool things in this particular film. But Joan Watson of Elementary is definitely one of the highest profile female Watsons I've ever seen. Because that was like a 70s film I was referencing, and then a 70s CBS show.
I mean, I think by adding, by creating Watson as a female character, it gives you so much more you can do with it. Develop the relationship even further than, you know, out of the books.
There's all kinds of options, yeah. They can go anywhere.
It was what they did with her that I objected to. I mean,
really?
The fact that she was the psychiatrist, that was following him around to keep him from his addiction and hired by his father. And he had that whole premise. It was the premise of it that I had difficulty with.
I have difficulty with the premise, too. That she's paid to be there as opposed to this guy is awesome.
Yeah.
She's not the first reluctant Watson, as a friend of mine recently pointed out. The Jude Law Watson's fairly reluctant to be there. he's basically following Holmes because Holmes throws his wife off a train. But Lucy Liz Watson, I wanted her to be a veteran, for one, because it'd be so easy. And there are so many female veterans now who were in Afghanistan and were in Iraq. And
why do you feel the need to be a veteran?
Because the John Watson of the books is a veteran.
Yeah.
And he specifically, it's talked about more in one that you haven't read yet at all. And which you're welcome to read if you'd like. A Study in Scarlet is the very first Sherlock Holmes novel. I think that it is a fun way to get into the canon, but I think the short stories are a lot more viscerally interesting right off the bat, as opposed to a novel, half of it set in Utah, like without Holmes and Watson in it at all. There are some really funny one-star reviews of it on Amazon where the people will be like, I've downloaded this Sherlock Holmes novel and the first half has Sherlock Holmes and John Watson and then like the second half is all these Mormons and it's the wrong book. one star. And then like, I contacted Amazon to try to fix it on my Kindle and they haven't said anything to me. Which is hilarious to me. But half of it doesn't involve him at all. So I didn't want to start with it. I wanted to start with the short stories. But yeah, he was wounded in the Afghan war. And then he comes back wounded. And he just needs something. There's something missing. He was fighting the good fight over there. And he almost died. And he gets sent back. He has some PTSD issues. And he needs something to do.
They give that to this character. She was a physician. And they set up that she lost, I guess, the patient. Right?
You're right. So there's trauma there.
Surgeon.
So there is trauma in her.
Who let her patient die on the table?
Exactly. Yes. With that exact face.
She's a surgeon and a psychiatrist.
She's a surgeon turned sort of addict sitter. She's a sober companion. So she's a surgeon who's got a new career as somebody who's helping people in recovery from addiction problems. She's basically like a social worker, yes. So it's interesting, and I'm, you know, all of these adaptations, there's room for all of them, which is cool. There's space for all of them, and there's so much space left behind in the original stories that you can create Sherlock Holmes as a mouse and call it the Great Mouse Detective, and you can watch it, and it's still Sherlock Holmes, and you're still super stoked.
They all, though, seem to be now, they all try and capture the frantic energy.
That's absolutely true.
Like, that's been consistent, no matter. Yeah. And then the relationships always—they at least on the screen—they appear to be as tight as they are in the book.
I think that is one of the most gratifying things about recent adaptations, including Warner Brothers, including BBC. We'll see where Elementary takes it, and I'm sure they're going to be taking it much further, since at the moment she's paid to be there. But I don't think that can't be permanent, and she's obviously fascinated by it. So they really have captured this dynamic duo in a lot of widely divergent adaptations that exist now. It's like a new Sherlockian renaissance. I'm happy to be alive. What's going on? I had a handout for you guys.
What do you think of the actor who's playing Sherlock Holmes? How do you think he's playing that? How well do you think he's playing that role?
Johnny Lynn Miller?
Yeah.
In the elementary?
In the elementary.
I think he's very charming. I think he's warm. I think they have good chemistry together. The one thing that I'm not quite, like, sold on at the moment is I find that with Benedict Cumberbatch in the BBC series and Robert Downey Jr. as well in the Warner Brothers series, if they stop and they're thinking, I can see whole universes behind their eyeballs. Like, I can see the wheels turning at incredibly fast speeds. And at the moment, I feel like when I'm watching Miller, he seems like a very talented, clever investigator. I don't know that he reads genius on screen to me. But I think he's very engaging. And I think as an actor, he's extremely talented. He did a production with Benedict Cumberbatch, of all people, at the National Theater, in which they alternated every night playing the roles of Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster, which was extremely challenging. And, you know, like, one night be Cumberbatch as the monster, the next night it would be Miller as the monster, and vice versa. And they're both extraordinary actors. So I think that this is a Holmes you're looking at where the writers specifically wanted him to be kind of at rock bottom at this point. He's hit a low tide, and I'd like to see where he goes from there. But the actor is really good.
He does a British accent.
He's British.
Is he?
He's British.
Because that is almost impossible.
Yes. Yes, it is.
An American British accent.
Well, speaking of another brilliant Sherlock Holmes adaptation, Gregory House was played by an Englishman also, who had the most extraordinarily good American accent I've ever heard from an Englishman. So, like, yeah, it's hard to tell sometimes, but it's really, really difficult for Americans to put on British accents. And Johnny Lee Miller is British.
I wanted to ask you what you thought of House as an adaptation, because my mom really loves that show, and mm-hmm. I didn't really like it the first few times I watched it with her, and then once I found out that it was supposed to be like a Holmes adaptation, I appreciated it more
yeah.
and kind of got more into it.
Uh-huh.
So, what did you think of it?
I love House. Yeah. I've watched every episode of House, 100% of them. I've seen all of them. And House is interesting because it's just sort of sly nods. So in the very first episode, for instance, his patient's name is Irene Adler. And you see him, the writers were pretty open about the fact that it was a Sherlock Holmes adaptation. But you see him, for instance, when he is going into his apartment, he lives very clearly at 221, and apartment B is right on his door. And he plays the piano as opposed to the violin. He's addicted to Vicodin instead of cocaine and morphine. So there's just all of these things that are slightly to left of center. He's a doctor who is an investigator instead of a detective who's an investigator. He is based very much on the person that Conan Doyle based Sherlock Holmes on, Dr. Joseph Bell. So you've got Dr. Joseph Bell, who Shaven also mentioned in the article, who would say these extraordinary deductions about patients and just wow everybody, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, before he was a knight. And that's basically the character of House, which is super cool. It's almost back to origins, right? He doesn't need to be a detective even. And then, of course, you've got House, Wilson, Holmes, Watson. And the final episode of House, and I won't spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but it is very canonical. It's based a bit on the final problem. So, and then at the end of it, at the end of that series, what you take away from it again is this, like, long, long arc of a truly screwed up guy who has one friend. And that's it. And fortunately, that's all he really needs, is that one friend.
It's a lot.
It is a lot. It's a lot to have one friend. That's an extraordinary thing to have that relationship in your life. Like, and it's so pretty to look at that people keep adapting it over and over and over and over again. But I think particularly Wilson, James Wilson, he's a great Watson.
Yeah.
Like, Robert Sean Leonard is an extraordinary Watson. He's so charming and just warm and like, no, I'm not doing this. No. No. He's got sass. He's got courage.
I thought of one of the elementary. One thing that's different is his liaison in the police department.
Mm-hmm.
He's a bumbling, you know, fool.
Yeah.
he's a little more down, you know, down earth or whatever, but then the characters around him in the police department are always coming up with the wrong, you know.
You sort of see that in the BBC one also. Like, Lestrade isn't a total idiot.
Which is good.
Yeah.
I think it's important when they do that in the adaptations because it kind of beggars belief that you would have all of the professional people at Scotland Yard be just terrible.
Right.
At their jobs.
And if they're idiots, that makes his accomplishments less impressive. Mm-hmm. That's what he's working against. It's better when he has competent people to bounce off.
That is exactly right. Because it would not be necessary to have a genius in the room if you, you know, were working with total incompetence.
We could probably do it faster than Lestrade.
Right. Right. It's interesting, you've got these various levels of intelligence going on in the stories, like, and the argument that I mentioned last time, where you're sort of, you're not going to keep up with Sherlock Holmes, no one can keep up with Sherlock Holmes, but you might be one step ahead of Watson, maybe, in something like the Red-Headed League, where you're like, people are digging, they have a photography habit, like, there's a bank nearby, like, you sort of get it a little bit more Watson catches-wise, but never as quickly as Sherlock Holmes does. And so you're in this very happy place between all kinds of competent, intelligent people, which is what I think I have a problem with the Rathbone films, not because I don't think Rathbone was good. I think he was very good. And I think Nigel Bruce was charming, but if there was a banana peel, Nigel Bruce was going to, like, it was going to take him out. Like, you could dangle a banana peel anywhere and Nigel Bruce would lose it to the banana. And that's what's extraordinary about Nigel Bruce, is that following those films, Watson was never ignored again because it was discovered that Sherlock Holmes really needed a partner. And previous to that, you had a lot of Sherlock Holmes film adaptations that just skipped Watson, including, to a large extent, the Gillette productions really didn't feature Watson at all. It featured the great detective running around being heroic and very melodramatic. After Bruce, we're grateful to Bruce for bringing Watson back into the spotlight. But he's a little bit bumbling and maybe being too kind. So I like these later adaptations where Watson is really the guy to bring the service revolver and provide the heavy guns. I really want Joan Watson on Elementary to invest in a pistol. She's an American. She can get her hands on it. It's not going to be hard. So I'm at a loss to know what to do right now because there's a handout I have for you, but I didn't photocopy it. I had to come in here and do that meeting with mystery writers. And so I can send it to you online. Would that be suitable? Would that be okay for me to send it to everybody online? And you guys all got my email this last time, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to email it to you instead of wandering through the empty building trying to find the photocopies that Kristen so kindly made for me, and I'll send her a long apology note about being very, very sorry. But I know Hound of the Baskervilles is longer, so what we're going to talk about next time is going to be Hound of the Baskervilles, and then this piece is just this very, very short essay that I wrote that is called The Hound Isn't the Point, and it is just an essay that I wrote that was published in the at the Edgar Awards at MWA last April. So I'll just send you the file, and hopefully you guys can read it, and if you have any issues opening the Word document or anything like that, let me know. I'll pop it in the snail mail for you. I'll put stamps on it. I'm happy to do that. So you could just let me know if it doesn't work somehow. But it's like 3 pages. It's really easy. I just wanted to, this time, like, sort of expand our understanding of how the world of Sherlock Holmes expands exponentially because of this stuff that goes down with his death. Like, and I always come back to that as sort of the origin of when people... It was 10 years for the general public thinking Holmes was dead. I mean, I'm suffering enough waiting for the 3rd season of BBC Sherlock.
That was the spread? It was 10 years,
yeah. And it was 8 years before there was another Sherlock Holmes story. So 8 years after Sherlock Holmes died, Hound of the Baskervilles came out. But he was supposed to still be dead. And it was like this sort of, oh, this is a story that took place before he died in the waterfall. I'm just telling this story because I'm giving it to you. And then it was 10 years between the final problem and the empty house.
That's pretty amazing that he was able to, the audience just picked up.
Oh, they just came back at, like, lapping at it like rabid dogs.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if you had a success hit today.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a decade later, you think you can bring back the audience.
Yesterday's news.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really akin to the Harry Potter books in that way. I mean, I think if J.K. Rowling were to come back and say, I have written a prequel to the Harry Potter books instead of an adult novel, people would be out there. It wouldn't matter if it was 5 years from now or 10 years from now. I think people would be lapping it up. But,
all the adventures in print at that time also?
They were in print. They've never been out of print.
So they were probably picking up more readers during those 10 years even.
They were. And they were on a trajectory that that if people hadn't been subscribers to the Strand magazine, then after the fact, they were still picking them up in the collected The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes and The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. So they were buying these short story collections after the fact of the temporary disposable magazine had already, you know, done its duty. Yeah, so it was still picking up readership all that way.
What was it competing against at that time?
It was competing against a number of other, there were a lot of other adventure stories in the Strand. There were no serialized detectives who existed. Specific thing that was extraordinary about the Sherlock Holmes mysteries was that these cases were self-contained. So the Strand wanted to have all of their stories be self-contained, have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then you come to the end of this short story, you could read through the whole Strand magazine and not hit a cliffhanger, and just be like, okay, I'm done with this magazine. That was great. It had cool illustrations, it had a great story, it had that other great story, I really enjoyed that. I don't have to keep a plot in my head to be continued for next week. So it was in competition with nobody in terms of serialized detective stories that were very episodic, the way we would wait for a show like the next episode of Lost, or, you know, that even is not a particularly good example, because that's not self-contained. That's something that you're going to be building your information about episode to episode. House is probably a better example. Everybody was really into House, and those episodes, to a great extent, existed in sort of a self-contained world. You had the person who they were trying to cure. By the end of the episode, that person either was cured or was not cured, and you went on about your business.
Was he the first one for the Strand to sort of write like that?
Yeah. To write a detective story like that, yes. Which is why basically all detective stories since then are based on Sherlock Holmes. Which is awesome. Yeah, and we can talk about any of those other things more next time as well. So thank you, and I'm so sorry that I don't have the printed handout for you, but I will email it to you post-haste, and I don't know if you started, thank you, I don't know if you started Hunt of the Baskervilles yet, but it's really fun, and I think it's one of the, well, I like Sign of Four too, but Hunt of the Baskervilles is a great novel. And it was so nice to see you.
Is the dog consider the family Baskervilles special?
Was there any? Wow. It was, jeez. It was certainly his most popular. He considered some of his best work to be his historical fiction, to be honest. And his fiction that was deliberately historically based and was stuff like The White Company, he considered to be his best work. I think he also was a big fan of The Lost World, and I would be happy to look that up and tell you exactly what he thought his best work was next time. But it ran more along the lines of The Lost World and The White Company, his historical stuff, than anything to do with that jerk in the Deerstalker hat.
Thank you.
Thank you.